podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. The English cricket season is nearly over, although actually it's been rather sunny this week, so some final games in the county championship have been able to be undertaken. But of course, the cricket bandwagon rolls on and England's touring parties to Sri Lanka already been announced. They're heading off for the one-day series on Sunday, actually, so no rest for the wicked, of course. And we're going to look ahead to the Sri Lanka series and have a look at the squads. And also we're going to talk to one of the big retirements of the county season. Paul Collingwood, of course, announced his retirement, playing his last match this week against Middlesex for Durham. So we're going to hear from him about how the game has changed in due course. But first, Simon, I suppose we should just look at the successes of the summer. It's been an interesting summer in that the selections have been quite adventurous and some of them have proved dividends for England.
Absolutely. The likes of Sam Curran, fantastic pick. If you'd said at the start of the summer, you know, if you'd said in April, that this summer, Bess, Pope, Sam Curran, Rory Burns, Joe Denley and Ollie Stone would all be picked in England Test squads, you probably wouldn't believe it, would you? I mean, it's been a quite remarkable summer in that sense. Three 20-year-olds and a 32-year-old. You don't get many of those picked for the first time, but Joe Denley has been given the nod. It was touted for a while, actually. You know, Ed Smith allowed it to get out there that Joe Denley was in the frame. There was some talk that he was going to be picked during the India series. Well, they just held off on that, and he's been picked for Sri Lanka. It shows that you got to keep on believing, I suppose.
And it's encouragement for second division batsmen as well, because, you know, sometimes people have said in the past, well, you can't really consider someone's second division runs, but Denley has done the business, actually at number four most of the time, although I think he's being looked at as a potential opener. So it's going to be a bit of a three-way shootout, I suppose, in the early stages of the Test tour between him, Rory Burns and Keaton Jennings to see which ones have got the game for the slightly tricky pitches in Sri Lanka.
Right at the start of the season, we went to the Oval and we watched Rory Burns play, and yeah, your observations on him were?
I thought he had a crabby technique. I also thought that he looked as if he had a very good temperament, and that's been proved by just reeling off, yeah, you know, 50 after 100 after 50 after 100 and going past 1,000 runs. He has the benefit of playing at the Oval, but we've seen actually in certainly the Test match and even this week, it's not always easy batting at the Oval. Surrey bowled out for 67 today in just 20-odd overs. So it's not just a straightforward matter of putting bat to ball at the Oval and making runs. Burns has done the job both home and away. And although he's got a crabby kind of method, which looks a bit ugly, you've got two people that you could sort of almost relate to as similar or people he might have learnt from. Dean Elgar, playing for Surrey now, who has a pretty ugly technique. And before him, Graham Smith, who had a horrible technique and made, you know, 10,000 test runs. So there are precedents to playing in an ugly way as long as it works for you. Steve Smith, another example. If it works for you, why change it?
Does Burns remind you a bit of Graham Smith?
He does, actually. He's not a sort of beefy, but it's certainly in the way that the bat is picked up kind of to gully, and then he's very strong off his legs, as obviously Smith was. The bat sometimes seems to come down with a closed face, and again, that was very Graham Smith. So, yeah, I mean, there are elements that are like that, but you just have to hand it to him for constantly churning out runs and being captain and not appearing to be burdened by captaincy particularly, and just constantly being reliable and responsible and delivering.
Is he unignorable or is he the last resort? I mean, they picked so many openers. They tried so many options. They got eventually to Rory Burns. Having said that, you know, his record has been excellent.
Yeah, I think that
should they have got there earlier?
Well, yes, maybe. But there were other people who were clamouring to be included. And I think probably that Burns' method might have been held against him slightly in that he was getting runs, but people, perhaps selectors in the past, might have looked at him and gone, well, he just doesn't look as if he has the game. He doesn't look like a test player somehow, which is maybe a bit unfair. I think the other thing, just to say, you know, with a little bit of sympathy towards all these openers who've been tried, is opening the batting is incredibly tough in test cricket. You know, the pitches have got a lot more grass on them than they would have had 10 years ago. Why that is, it's a combination of groundsmen being encouraged to leave grass on for the England seam bowlers, also wanting to keep the ball carrying through, making it a more interesting game because grass encourages extra bounce, perhaps not wanting pitches to break up, the extra covering, the excellent covering of pitches these days, which sort of maybe keeps the kind of growth and the moisture in a bit more when they're covered as they are. I don't know. I mean, it's a combination of things, but it is tough opening the batting.
Yeah. Probably the most exciting pick, England's test squad, Ollie Stone, 24 years of age. His first-class record is very good. We know he's got some pace. 33 first-class matches, 110 wickets at 24. Those are stats not to be sneezed at. And one factor or one criticism, that, if you like, that came out of England's tour of Australia last year, no pace. And Broad, Anderson and Wokes have been selected again for a winter tour. And, you know, they it was hard work for them in Australia as a collective last winter. They've gone for Ollie Stone, who is quick. You know, he can bowl at 90 miles an hour. So there is, you know, there is a slight shift there, even though they have gone for the old firm, if you like, Broad, Anderson and Wokes.
Well, I think that's a good choice by England, because that was the lack last winter, and Mark Wood was sort of around the squad but didn't ever really be involved until near the end. In fact, he didn't play until New Zealand, did he? So it seemed a waste, actually, to not have somebody like him available. So Ollie Stone is the sort of next one off the rank. I guess they could have tried Jamie Overton as well, but they're perhaps more convinced about the robustness of Ollie Stone's action. I mean, he certainly looks aggressive fast bowler, as well as being very strong. Whether he'll play or not, I don't know, because, you know, a lot of people saying, well, should Anderson or Broad be rested? Well, in a way, rested from what? You know, they only got to play three tests and then they've got about 2 months off. So their skills are so exceptional and they're so desperate to prove themselves away from home that, you know, they're automatic picks.
So it might be hard for Stone to get in. It might be hard for Wokes to get in, actually. When you look at it, you think that they're going to be lots of spinners used, so you might have a three-man pace attack, and Stokes is going to be one of them, you think, and Anderson's going to be the other. And there's one spot, and Sam Curran, you know, he's had a magnificent summer. You know, do you leave him out? Anyway, that's to be sorted out.
Talking of unusual things, by the way, I bet Sam Curran, if he thought at the beginning of the season that not only would he be man of the series against India in the Test Series, but also now, where Surrey are playing their last game, he's actually in Croatia on holiday because he's been given the last two games off. So, God, his season's been a surprise in many ways. We'll probably, hopefully, hear from him next week, actually, when he's back. But in the meantime, our interviewee this week is Paul Collingwood, who, of course, has just announced his retirement. But you've got another good reason why we should have him on.
Well, England last won a one-day series in Sri Lanka under Paul Collingwood's captaincy in 2007. In fact, he's the only England captain to lead England to a one-day series victory in Sri Lanka. It's always hard work out there. You know, even if you think England have got a really strong one-day side, which they have, and a potential World Cup winners, they will still find it tough out there. The heat, the humidity, you know, the conditions, and, you know, just the general skillfulness of Sri Lanka players in their own conditions. So it'll be tough for England. But anyway, Collingwood was the only man to captain England to a one-day win. 2007.
Yeah, yeah.
3-2.
It shows how long he's been playing the game, because he actually watched me play for Durham. So he's been around a long time. He was only a teenager, then about 16. He got into the Durham side when I think he was 19 or 20. And 1996, he made his debut. How the game has changed. And that was the question that I put to him first. In that 22 years of his first-class career, it must have struck him how incredibly the game has changed in that time.
When I first started playing in 2001... I remember you probably had two or three batsmen maximum in the opposition that could put you into Rose Ed. But now you see every team, pretty much, you'll have seven or eight. So the power is certainly improved. I think the, you know, that what people can achieve. We used to get told off for getting caught in the boundary when I first started playing the game, and I think the whole mentality towards one day batting just changed. You were almost encouraged later on in my career to take the boundary riders on, because you knew if you got half a batting move, you could get it over the heads. So just the whole mentality, the confidence of batsmen has changed. You know, scores have reflected that.
Is it a better game, do you think?
I think it's a lot more skillful, yeah. I genuinely think the game of cricket has probably improved more than what people realise. I get a little bit disheartened when you hear people talk about bowlers nowadays not as good as the bowlers in the past. I think the batsmen are making it look easier. And the way that they play pace, it's still scary. It's still, you know, it gets the adrenaline going, all that kind of stuff. But players, certainly in the white ball game, players play pace, as if it's medium paces. But the thing I would say, it's the skill level of bowlers when the ball is moving, when that red ball is moving. I think that most bowlers now can swing it both ways, have unbelievable accuracy. And I think that's, again, you're seeing batsmen really struggle against the moving ball now. There's just no respite. You know, the ability of bowlers in every single country, you've got these bowlers who can swing it both ways and nip it both ways. There's just no respite, especially for opening batsmen.
Yeah.
Some genuine 4-day cricketers from county level go into Keaton Jennings, for example.
Mark Stoneman before him as well, both Durham. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you would say that I would certainly say Keats's game isn't a T20 game. So people who could say, oh, well, everybody's got one-day techniques now and want to go after the ball. Keats isn't a one-day technique. He's a set for the longer version of the game. And the way you saw Morkel and Philander, you know, just go about their business was absolutely, I mean, the skill level was through the roof. I mean, the information that people have got now, the wobble seam, all this kind of stuff, is something that everybody practices.
I suppose, in a way, it's partly down to preparation then, in a way, because you're saying that, you know, the ability of batsmen against quick bowling, certainly with the white ball, is highly impressive, and it makes quick bowlers look like medium pacers, and yet they can't necessarily cope with the moving ball, because perhaps the bowlers in 4-day or 5-day cricket have become, you know, even more skillful. So skills in batting have increased and improved in 1-day cricket, but skills in bowling have sort of increased in Test cricket, and that's why there's this.
I generally think that, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I was coaching that game in Mumbai in the T20 World Cup, and when we had a knock-off 230 against South Africa, and all their bowlers were 90 mile an hour plus, and I'm thinking, we've got no chance of doing this. and to watch the guys go, well, we were 44 off two overs. And it was like, these aren't just regulation bowlers we're talking about. It's Rabada. This is Morris. This was
Stain.
You go through that lineup. It was serious pace bowling. And I'm a coach. Obviously, I'm sitting there just watching this. Saying, this is absolutely incredible. How much the game has changed. I mean, we would never have been able to do that in our day. One of the big things is the kind of the belief that batsmen have now. Of what can be achieved is so much greater than back in when I first started.
Well, that's Paul Collingwood. More from Paul after the break. The game has changed enormously, according to him. Do you think that's true? I mean, are bowlers faster? Are batsmen better? I mean, it's something you've touched on before, actually. When you look at things, when you look at athletics, everyone says everything improves, don't they? But actually, in the shoulder disciplines in athletics, you've mentioned this before, hammer, discus, javelin, all the world records stand from the 1980s. They haven't been improved upon since the 1980s. So I'm sceptical about whether the bowlers are fast. I know Alistair Cook says, the bowlers must be faster now than they were in the 1980s because everything else has improved. You know, and there's West Indies fast bowlers. You know, they couldn't have been as quick as everyone said they were at the time. If you look at the hammer, discus and javelin world record, it suggests that actually, you know, there's no reason why the fast bowlers of the 1980s are not quicker than the ones of today.
No, I think that those bowlers were an exceptional group. And they were probably the fastest group of bowlers who've ever lived. And group is probably an important word because there are still isolated examples of very fast bowlers now. Mitchell Johnson, I think, probably bowled the fastest sort of selection of spells in that Ashes when England were beaten 5-0 that has been seen in modern times in the last, say, 10 years. But Mitchell Starc produces the odd spell like that. I mean, if you go back 10 years or so, Shoaib Akhtar, Brett Lee, you know, there are isolated examples. I think Rabada, probably, Dale Steyn. You know, they do produce the odd spell of very fast bowling. But those West Indians, there were about eight of them, who all kind of just rotated. And that's what made them so elite.
Yeah. Has the game changed as much as Paul Collingwood says it has? Something. I was talking to Geoffrey Boycott in the back of the commentary box during the India Test series. We were debating the England Test 11, you know, that greatest England Test 11. Some people had W.G. Grace in it. And I said, well, you, Geoffrey, could play now, you know, and you think of the sort of the gap, you know, say the 70s to the 2010s. You could have played now. Len Hutton could have played in the 1970s. But could W.G. Grace, I know he was a dominant figure in the 19th century, but could W.G. Grace, say, have played in the... Would he have been good enough to play in Hutton's time? Because what I'm saying, you know, has the game sort of advanced
much? That's going a bit too far back, isn't it? But certainly Bradman could have played in the modern game. In fact, you know, Bradman's sort of modern reincarnation is a sort of Steve Smith kind of style. I mean, we compared the two methods, and they are quite similar. So if you're that good, you're able to adapt. I mean, W.G. Grace actually was the first person who played back and forward. Mm. Before that, everybody just played back, and he worked out that you could also play forward. So in a way, he was an innovator of his time, and he would have been able to innovate if he'd been born now.
Really? So you think he'd have been as good in the modern game? Well, the point I was making...
He was a huge bloke as well. Yeah. I mean, massively tall. Yeah. I mean, he wouldn't have had to do too much gym work to hit the ball out of the ground, I wouldn't have thought, with the modern bats.
I think the point I was making in the 19th century, because the game was relatively undeveloped, you know, if one superstar came along, he was bound to be much better than, you know, comparatively than everyone else. But now there's the game has developed, there's a greater...
So you mean everybody's sort of more of an equal level?
Everyone's gone up
just
a level.
I mean, just to answer your question about, you know, has the game improved or has it developed, I was struck actually by having a net with a net in inverted commas with Ben Stokes a couple of years ago, and it really kind of came home to me how powerful the modern batsmen are, because I was bowling a couple of, you know, very modest medium paces to him to explore some of his shots for a video that I was making, and he blocked one ball, not too many, I have to say, but he blocked one, and I sort of put my hand down to stop it because it was a normal sort of regulation block, and it virtually took my shin off, and that was just a normal Ben Stokes block. And even the Graham Gooches and, you know, Robin Smiths and people like that of the 1980s wouldn't have had quite the same blocking power as the modern player. So when they really do spread their arms or extend their arms, as it were, batting, then definitely that the power is there that there never was in the past. And if you look at the techniques now as well, all the batsmen stand with the bat up like a baseballer. So there is going to be more momentum in the shot. It's a modern approach to the game, but it has a lot of logic to it, and that's how they hit the ball so far, because the bat, it goes right back up, sort of perpendicular to the ground, you know, pointing to the sky, and then the follow-through is almost like a golf follow-through. So there is this sort of 360-degree rotation of the bat that is just going to hit the ball further, added to the fact that they're also fitter and stronger. Mm.
So power batting, that really has been a change. And Paul was mentioning that, wasn't he, in that England's win against South Africa in Mumbai.
Which was a remarkable win. And the other thing is, that it, I thought his interesting point there was the skills of bowlers. And, you know, you've even seen that today on telly in the county championship, the ball zipping around from people you've never really heard of, making the ball move and just being able to really fine-tune those seam bowling skills. I would certainly say that 20 years ago, you got a few pretty good fast bowlers, but they didn't have the precise skills, the control of swing. You know, I swung the ball both ways. I was quite unusual. Ian Botham could, and there was a couple of others around. But not many people could swing the ball both ways, whereas now, you know, bowlers are able to move the ball almost at will.
OK, we'll hear more from Paul Collingwood after the break, and I'll also pose you a question.
Welcome back. And by the way, if you do enjoy this podcast, would you please leave us a review on iTunes? It always helps to get a bit of feedback. And sometimes, actually, people have said it in the past that the audio levels aren't very good, for instance. So anything that you've got that is a comment on this podcast, please leave it on iTunes when you get a minute. That'd be really helpful.
And if you like it, tell someone else about it and they might be able to enjoy it as well. Now, I've got a question for you, Simon. We talked about Paul Collingwood before the break. We'll hear a bit more from him in just a moment. If you think about Paul Collingwood's raw materials as a cricketer, has there ever been any cricketers play for England that's been as successful as Collingwood? That might sound a strange thing to say. Oh, yeah, there were much greater players. But you think of the raw material. I mean, what do you describe him as?
Well, he was a leg-side shoveler who bowled a few, you know, trundlers, and he was a pretty good fielder.
But he played 301 times for England. He averaged 40 in Test cricket. He made 10 Test match hundreds. He played 197 one-day internationals. I mean, that is a remarkable record for a player, as you described, who's a leg-side shoveler who bowled medium pace and could field a bit.
It is a fantastic performance. In fact, Andrew Strauss, on Collingwood's retirement from Test cricket in Sydney in 2011, he said, "You have made the absolute most out of your ability. You should be very proud." And I think Collingwood was very proud. I remember him, actually. I did a little video with him that day at Sydney when he announced his retirement. England had won the Ashes and he'd contributed, you know, usefully in most of the games. And he just kissed his England cap in great pride and said, "You know, I've got blood and sweat and all sorts all over this, but, you know, I'm absolutely proud of what I've achieved." And actually, if you look at his record, he's actually averaged better in Test cricket with the bat than in first class. His first class average is only 35. His Test average is 40. 10 Test hundreds. Yeah. You know, fantastic performance. Never mind the brilliance in the field and obviously his contributions with the ball. And just being an inspiration to everyone, really, in the way he applied himself. Is he the most successful player of, let's say, limited ability? I suppose you could put Alistair Cook in that bracket. You know, 12,000 runs with three basic shots. But he was always exceptional, even as a 21-year-old. I remember before he got picked for England, he got a double 100 against Australia. Yeah. So, you know, he was... That's for Essex. So, I mean, there was something fairly special about Cook, even though it didn't look it. Whereas with Collingwood, he's a utility...
Yeah, 21, you wouldn't have said Paul Collingwood was going to play 300 times for England, would you?
No.
No.
He's a utility player who made, you know, brilliant decisions, was fantastically reliable, worked his absolute bollocks off, as he, you know, freely admits, stayed fit, tried to adapt all the time. And actually, you know, that was one of the things I talked to him about is... You know, he was something of a pioneer, I felt, when he first came into one-day cricket. But he sort of denies that and says he was just a decent player who's had to keep adapting. And that's the way he's been able to survive.
I wouldn't say I was a pioneer or anything. In the fielding sense, I think I was better than most when it came to fielding. But now you look at fielding. Mm. If I'm to field in this current day and age, I don't think I would stand out. I think most of the cricketers are athletes. You know, some of the catches that you've seen on the boundary, the way that they're diving around in the field is, it's just the norm now.
You've done amazingly well then to survive 22 years. How you know, what do you put that down to?
Well, I've had to develop. I've had to keep, you know, developing the game. Certainly I had to work on the offside play. So, you know, if you're not improving by 10% every year, then, you know, you're going backwards. And you know, you've got to have that kind of drive and desire to keep improving. Obviously, you've got to keep yourself physically fit as well along the way. But a lot of it comes down to experience as well, as you know, the situations that you're playing in, what is needed. So experience does help, but at the same time, you've got to keep working on your skills to keep up with all these youngsters that are coming into the game.
Yeah,
because a lot of them are fairly impressive.
How about Durham? The state of Durham now. I mean, obviously, you've come off a pretty hefty defeat and having to deal with Mohamed Abbas. You didn't mention Mohamed Abbas as a bowler with modern skills, and I can see he must be a handful. But what about Durham's sort of present and future, having been there for so long yourself?
Yeah, look, obviously, when you come off a defeat like we did last week, then people are going to say it's in a bit of a dire situation. That's not the case at all. We come up against a world-class bowler with Storm Alley right up his backside and on a green top at Leicester. Our skills just couldn't actually cope with him on the day. So, but from an overall point of view, Durham is in very safe hands now. And, you know, it was devastating what happened with the finances a couple of years ago. And we're still getting punished now, even from the relegation and obviously players leaving. I guess it was almost like a 4 or 5 year punishment rather than just everybody seeing it as a 1 year punishment. But I generally think we've turned the corner. I think we've got some great men involved. Obviously, Biffy at the top as chairman, Tim Bostock as chief exec, has got a great sporting mind on him who can take the club forward. And I think we've recruited some very good players. Which is a great sign. When we're recruiting and bringing good players back into the club, then it's a sign that we've got ourselves back on our feet and wanting to move forward again.
And will you stay involved?
I will have to wait and see. I'm just at this moment in time. I've got me 2 months with England sorted through the winter, but nothing is concrete with any other coaching role at this moment. So I'm just bit of a blank canvas for me, to be honest. I'm announcing my retirement and then seeing what kind of jobs are out there, which is quite exciting. I've got no regrets whatsoever. I generally think I've got every ounce of my ability out of my body and given it the best crack that I could have. You know, I love playing for England. I think that was always my ambition when I was a kid growing up, was to wear the three lines. And to have done that over 300 times, I'd never have dreamt of that when I was that young.
One final question. Do we need the 100, or what's your view on the 100?
I'm not sure whether we need it or not. I love 2020 cricket. I think if we marketed a 2020 competition in England like we're trying to market the 100 ball competition, then I think it would have been successful. But we got to give it a crack. They want to see what it's like, so why not give it a crack and hopefully make it work?
Well, that's Paul Collingwood. We'll give it a go. It's a bit like Collingwood's career, actually, isn't it? We'll give it a go. I think my strongest memory, actually, was his... I think he says it was one of his best ever memories in cricket, obviously winning the World T20. I mean, that's one thing we missed out, actually. When we went through all those things he's achieved in his career, we missed out the fact that he actually captained England to their only ever one-day or white ball...
Global
trophy. But anyway, that the best innings, or one of the best innings he says he's ever played, and I was there, that innings against South Africa that sort of saved his career when he made 100 at Edgbaston, when I remember Kevin Peterson trying to go to his 100 with a 6, and then Paul Collingwood got into the 90s, and he thought, Is he going to try it as well? And he did, and he pulled it off. He outdid Peterson that day, and it was sort of quite cheeky, actually. It was fascinating to watch it happen. It was a wonderful innings. Both were wonderful innings, actually. But of course, South Africa went on to win the game because Graham Smith played an even better innings than the one Paul Collingwood played, and that was the end of Michael Vaughan's captaincy. So,
I mean, a fantastic career, Paul Collingwood, and. Really, I just sort of want to say thank you to him, really, for the effort that he's put in over the 22 years, both for Durham and England. And actually, since he retired from playing for England, you know, he's done so much off the field, done the coaching with England on tour, one day series especially.
And with Scotland as well.
He coached Scotland
at the World Cup.
And he'll be doing plenty of coaching, believe me, from now on, in all sorts of guises. But I just love the way that in the Caribbean last winter, that he was sprinting up and down with Johnny Bairstow in the lunch breaks or breaks between innings and things like that, and keeping up with the younger players. A fantastic survivor.
Well, there's something truly to be appreciated about someone who can make the most of their ability. And I think Paul Collingwood did that.
That's a good moment to end, isn't it, really? A good epitaph. Made the most of himself. I hope someone puts that on my gravestone.
I doubt it, Jose.
Anyway.
Underachieved just about every day of his life.
Oh, thanks. And you are a great bloke as well. Lovely to see you. Anyway, we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Podcast Network.